Welcome to Multifamily Rockstars. It's Ryan here. The following episode was recorded from our live in-person meetup in Houston, Texas. Today's guest is Vince Porter from Porter & Company, a Dallas-based real estate CPA firm. Vince shares the powerful tax benefits of real estate investing and how to be smart about tax planning. Hear his real estate tax tips and case studies for passive investors and active syndicators. Please visit lifechangingcapital.com to learn more about the diversification, passive income, and tax benefits associated with multifamily investing.
Thanks again. We have Vince Porter. He is actually the CPA for me personally and the three properties I'm a general partner on. And I just wanted to mention that in real estate, you know, we find it, and I guess in life in general, when you find someone that actually does what they say they're going to do in terms of, you know, timeliness, it means a lot. And, you know, Vince had all of our K-1s for our properties for all our investors on time and ahead of time, actually, so that, you know, it didn't delay any of our investors from filing their taxes, which, you know, as a passive investor, that's a really big thing. I'm invested passively in about 19 or so deals, and I've had to delay my filings because of just one passive deal. So it's important, the timeliness. So Vince came all the way from Dallas to be with us today, and he prepared a 20-page slide deck. And I know with all the lighting, it's probably going to be a little bit hard to see everything, but don't worry, we'll send it out after. Vince is very approachable, and he'll be around to take any questions, and he's done some scenario building and the power in the deck. So I'll just, before Vince comes up and starts the presentation, I just wanted to have Ravi, my co-host, you know, just provide some color on what's in front of you and kind of the layout for this launch.
All right, guys. Thanks again for everybody for coming. So a couple of administrative items. On the tables, you'll notice a placard, a laminated placard that has a QR code on it. On the side that's facing up, if you wouldn't mind just scanning with your phone and signing in, we just like to know who attended the session and comments on anything you'd like to see in future sessions. That would be fantastic. And on the reverse of the placard, Ryan and my information is there. So if you scan that QR code, it'll download our information onto your phone. So please do that as well. Reach out to us. We'd love to hear from you. You know, part of it is meeting all of you and networking with all of you, but also to build a community that hopefully we can build upon. So with that, we'll hand over to Vince.
Thank Vince you. Porter.
Yes, hold on.
Well, hello. How are you guys? Get the slide deck going and beat you guys with some real estate talk. I'm going to go page by page over the Internal Revenue Code and explain it all to you in deep, dark detail. You guys are going to be here for the next couple of days. I'm Vince Porter. I am a CPA. I am the president and CEO of Porter & Company CPAs, and we are a firm out of Dallas, and we're focused on entrepreneurs and investors with a focus on real estate. We've got a lot of clients inside the space. A lot of real estate investors, a lot of syndication groups. I've got clients that might have two or three single family doors, all the way up to clients with 500 plus doors on one deal and 200-300 investors. So that's what I do. We do the taxes for a lot of those clients. I'm also a passive investor. I've got a short-term rental, so not only am I professional in this space, I've got my money in this deal too, so I know a lot of what I'm talking about. I've been doing this for 20 plus years. I started my career at RSM McGladrey, and when I got there, they shoved me in the corner, and I did real estate tax returns for the first five years of my career, and I hated it. I thought that it was boring as could be. It's all I ever saw, and I wanted to get out of there as quick as I can. So I did what any aspiring young entrepreneur would do, and they followed in their dad's footsteps and left and went to his firm, and I joined him in 2005 and subsequently bought him out. And I took my real estate knowledge and I helped our investors and our clients at that time navigate the 2008-2009 downturn in the real estate economy and really helped them build their multifamily syndication groups. And we've kind of built on that throughout the course of my career. We got a staff of 7 or 8 in our office, so we're a small firm. We're not a big firm, but we work in this space, and I know this space well. And where we really provide our clients the most value is tax savings. We've saved our clients over $14 million in the last 3 years just by really educating them and putting plans into place that help them understand what the tax code says and how it benefits you, and then apply situations to them. So if you guys come out with anything here today, you need to know that the tax code is kind of geared toward the businesses. Before I get there, I'll show you my lovely family that you can't see there, but give you a little bit more context about me. I've got a blended family, so we've got a lot of kids. My wife has 3, I've got 2. We've got them all the way from first grade to a sophomore at A&M, and then there's some other ones in the middle there. I'm not sure what they're doing, but I pay to put a roof over their head. But that's what they do. I'm also a type 1 diabetic for the last 20 years, so I'm on the board of directors in Dallas for the JDRF, Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. So that's a little bit about me. $14.3 million, that's what we've saved our clients in tax dollars in the last 3 years. So that's a lot of strategies that apply directly to them. It could be cost segregation studies, which we'll talk a little bit about, retirement planning, shifting income into lower brackets that benefit our clients, a lot of different ways. So that's a lot of what we do and where we provide value for our clients. So as I kind of get back into it, the one thing that I can explain to you is the IRS tax code really rewards businesses. If you have a business, there's probably somewhere in the tax code that's going to benefit you, or there's going to be a tax deduction, there's going to be a tax credit. The government, if you scratch their back in terms of doing something to benefit the economy, you will be rewarded with either a tax deduction or a tax credit. So if we look on the top, if you've got a business, if you're an entrepreneur and you employ people, there's probably some big tax deductions and some tax credits in there. If you hire a segment of the population, say ex-cons or domestic abuse victims, there's a tax credit out there for it. The government incentivizes you to employ people who are in turn going to make a W-2, going to pay in taxes and pay more for them. Also, if you are in the real estate market, like a lot of you are, what we're here talking about today, if you provide affordable housing for people, that's going to generate W-2 income. Those people are going to pay taxes for it. The government's going to reward you with favorable tax rates, with lower, with tax deferral strategies, with cost segregation, depreciation. If you are providing income for low-income citizens, you can have a low-income tax credit, which could be a phenomenal benefit for you. So there's a lot of benefits for you having a business and providing something that the government wants. So now we'll kind of get to the meat of what we're talking about, and I really want to illustrate these returns for you. So if we take, I'm going to give you 3 scenarios and show you what taxes can really do for you. Let's say you got $10,000, and I can tell you you've got a 10% return for the next 30 years on that 10K, but you're in the 37% bracket, which is what the highest bracket is. It's going to go up to 39% once Congress passes through the new legislation. You're going to have $62,000 at the end of 30 years on that $10,000 investment. That's not bad. But what happens is you've had 10K grow to 92K, which is then going to be taxed at 37%. You're going to have 30K in taxes. You're going to be left with 62K. Something. But what happens when you have no returns, no tax rate? If you pay 0%, that same $10,000 on a 10% return, $174,000 at the end of it. We go one step forward, we talk about leverage. If you take that same $10,000, you put that on a down payment on a property or an asset, you have $50,000 of capital working for you. 0% tax, 10% return, $434,000 at the end of it. And that's what real estate can do for you. I know some of you in here are saying there's no way you can pay 0% taxes. There absolutely is a way, and it's legal. And that's one of our core values is honesty. I'm not going to do anything that's going to put you in jeopardy or put my pretty face in jail. I wouldn't do well in jail. So I'm not going to do anything for my clients that's going to get them in trouble. But real estate can provide you that opportunity to pay zero per taxes. If you 1031 over and over and over, put that into a trust, get a stepped up basis, which still exists today. There's a million different ways to do that, but that's the difference. Taxes get you $62,000 on a 10K investment. No taxes, 174. If you leverage that, like if you invested with Robbie or Ryan, you're gonna put 20% down, borrow the rest, let that money work for you. It's a phenomenal difference. So why does the government reward real estate? They don't want to do it. They don't want to provide citizens with housing. That's not what they're in the job to do. And as I said earlier, if you have an apartment complex and you provide housing for those people that are going to make W-2s, they're going to pay taxes. The IRS is going to reward you with big tax saving opportunities and big tax deductions. If you've got a commercial space where you host a popular Tex-Mex restaurant in the heart of Houston, you're going to get all sorts of tax benefits on this building. These people can probably write off a lot in depreciation. They can 1031 if they wanted to. All in all, these people are going to come in. They're going to pay the owner's money. They're going to pay taxes on their income. All the wait staff is going to report their tips legally, pay taxes on it. And it's a win-win for it. So the real estate investor that owns this piece of property or any type of real estate is going to get a big benefit. You could go down the list of what asset classes involve, like commercial, industrial. They're all kind of the same, but we're talking about residential real estate. So that's kind of where we'll stick to today. So let me go into some details of some of the tax benefits for you. Long-term capital gains rates. This has got a lot of buzz in the news lately because they're looking to increase the rate. But right now, if you have a capital asset, whether it be stock or real estate, you hold that for a year or longer, sell it for a gain, you've got a 20% tax. If you're in some lower income brackets, it could be a 15, 10%, or even 0% tax bracket. That's a lot better than some of the other assets out there. Depreciation bonus, 179, cost segregation depreciation. Does everybody in here know what cost segregation depreciation is? If you don't, you should. And you should ask your GPs if they know what it is. And if a GP doesn't know what cost segregation depreciation is, run. Come talk to these guys. Get out of there. It's one of the biggest single tax saving strategies that exist out there. So to explain what it is, if you've got an apartment building, let's just say you pay $1 million for an apartment. The IRS says that that's deducted over 27 and a half years. The IRS says you can't deduct land because land never depreciates. So you take the improvements, basically the physical tangible assets on top of that land. You depreciate that over 27 and a half years. That's roughly 3% a year. So in $1 million, we're talking maybe, I don't know, 90 grand of depreciation maybe over the next 27 years. What the IRS also says is you can do a cost segregation study where you have an engineer come out and look at that property and they can pull out the things like the HVAC systems, the plumbing, the interior finish out. All of that has a useful life of less than 27 years. Some of it's 15, some of it's 7, 5. Once you can pull those costs out of that big number, it goes into that 15, 7, 5-year property, and now it's depreciated much quicker. You get a bigger tax deduction. And to go even further, with the Tax and Job Cuts Act in 2017, by your then President Trump, who's also a real estate investor, anything that has 15 years or less is subject to bonus depreciation. So it can be depreciated fully in the first year. So if I go back to that same $1 million property that we can depreciate over 27 years at 90K a year, if I do a cost seg on that, I could pull out, what do you guys say, maybe two, $3 million maybe in depreciation in year one. I see it day in and day out. So let's take this $1 million property. Let's say it cash flows 100K. That's income to you guys as the investment group. Throw on top of that, so that's $100,000 in your pocket cash. If I can put a $2 million depreciation deduction on top of that, you got a tax loss of 1.9. And if you structure it right, that $1.9 million can then offset all of your other income and you can pay zero tax on it. And it's strategies like that that are tremendously beneficial. So cost segregation depreciation, you need to know what that is. You don't exactly need to know what it means, but if you're working with somebody that doesn't know what that is, or if you've got your money in real estate and don't know what that is, get with somebody that does. It's phenomenal. 1031 exchanges. Mark and I were talking about 1031 exchanges. That's where you can defer some of your sales and not pay the capital gains. So if you've got $1 million property, you sell it for $2 million, you got a capital gain of $1 million. Subject to ordinary or long-term capital gains rates, depending on how you structure that. If you do a 1031 exchange, what the IRS says is you can defer that gain by buying another piece of property, and you don't pay any tax on that gain. You will pay tax on the future sale of that, but not on that present gain. So 1031s are a big thing. Conservation easements is another strategy. I won't spend a lot of time on it, but it's a really cool deduction where if you've got land and you conserve that by not producing any, pulling any minerals off of it or producing future commercial development on that, the IRS will allow you to take a charitable contribution on that. And that can be a big tax savings to you if you do that. Opportunity zones, that's where you can work in the matter of kind of like a 1031 exchange where you can defer some of your capital gains by investing into designated areas that the IRS says need some development, and that can defer some gains. Passive income. Passive income, in this sense, what we're talking about that real estate does for you is it puts money in your pocket without you having to do a lot of things. If you're investing on one of these syndication deals, if you invest in the right deal and it's profitable, you're going to get cash distributions, money back into your pocket. We'll talk a little bit later about how that's not taxable. It's not taxable income directly to you, but it puts money in your pocket. But we'll talk further about what passive and non-passive income is, because it's a really big thing, and you guys need to understand that if you're looking to get into these deals or if you presently are in some of these deals. Self-directed IRAs, you can put your money from your IRA into a real estate deal if you want to do that. If any of you guys are familiar with Quest or any other custodians out there that do some of these deals, you can use your retirement funds to invest directly into real estate. Keep getting this feedback here. I can't tell where I need to put it. If you guys can't hear me, just let me know. And to compare this back to stocks, the reason I like real estate more than stocks, and everybody can kind of talk about this, but real estate's a tangible asset. I can see, I can touch, I can feel this building. If I go out and buy, you know, 100 shares of Google, I don't really have influence over what that stock price does. I have zero influence over that. But I do over this building. I can manage the heck out of this thing. It can make money for me. I can finance it at 3% and get a really low rate on it and have that produce income for me. You can't do that with stocks. Stocks are subject to capital loss limitations. If you lose money on a stock, it's going to be subject to a capital loss of $3,000 over and above your income. Structured right, real estate could be more than that. Stocks are subject to emotional responses. If I'm staring at the stock price of Microsoft today and it's just doing this and this and this, I can sell out of that really quickly. One of the good things about real estate, or one of the bad things, is it's not as liquid as what stocks are. So I can't go out and just unload this asset. It takes some work to do that. And sometimes that prevents you against yourself from going out and making rash emotional decisions that affect your finances. So Thanks. That feels much better.
Yeah, I think.
You guys want me to start over? Okay. All right. Passive loss. Now it's much louder. All right, passive loss of passive income. This is a big one, and you really need to understand it. I could do a deep dive. We could talk about this for a week and bore you guys to tears. But I want to give you the high-level notes of what this is. Real estate, in terms of the tax code, is passive income, and the losses are passive. What that means is if you have a loss in real estate, that's a passive loss. And that passive loss cannot be offset against non-passive income. Non-passive income is your W-2. If you have a business that's outside of real estate, that's non-passive income. You can't offset those losses. So you need to understand that, because that's a really big, important piece to this. When you have a passive loss and you have a and you're not able to utilize that, that loss doesn't go away. It's just suspended. And it's carried forward in the future. And the only way you can unlock those passive losses are a few different ways. One, you can wait till you have passive income generated, either from other real estate sources, or maybe you sell an asset. Maybe you sell one asset and you have passive losses built up over here. You can offset those. If you ever exit a project that has passive losses suspended, at that time, you can exercise those passive losses. Or you can be an active investor, and if you make more than $150,000 and you're actively managing that real estate, you can offset $25,000 of your ordinary income on passive losses. Or the big ticket is you can be a real estate professional. This is one of the biggest questions we get, and one of the biggest things clients want to know is, how can I be a real estate professional? Or they tell me they have a real estate license and they sold a couple of houses in 1989. They're basically a real estate professional. That's not what the tax code says. The tax code says you're a real estate professional if a few things happen. One, you spend 750 hours a year in real estate, meaning you're hosting investment lunches. You are actively looking out for deals. You're managing your existing properties. You're doing a lot of different things in the area of real estate. 750 hours is step one. That's roughly 20 hours a week. Step two, that trips a lot of people up, is you have to spend more than half your personal service time in the area of real estate. And the tax code is fraught with court cases that will throw out passive losses based on this. So if I'm a CPA and I work 40 hours a week at my CPA job, and I've got several other deals that I'm investing real estate in, and I meet the 750-hour requirement, I still then have to spend at least 40 hours a week or more, 50% or more of my personal service time in the area of real estate to qualify for real estate professional status. And that's what trips a lot of people up. I will never do that. There's not enough time in the day for me to do that. I don't want to do that. And there's just not enough going on in real estate that would negate that kind of time in that. And the IRS knows that. So if you have a W-2 from a job outside of real estate, it's, I don't want to say it's impossible, but it's really, really hard to do that. Yeah. Sure. Just on top of that, if your W-2's in real estate, will you qualify? If you have 5% or more ownership in that real estate company, that at that point, then that opens that up. Then, furthermore, this is the big circle. 750 hours, more than 50% of your personal time. Smaller circle is material participation. And I wrote a bunch of words up here that nobody can read. So just call me and I'll explain them all to you. But basically what material participation says is you've got seven different steps you've got to go to. Basically, you have to be the one working on that property. You have to spend more than 500 hours a year on that property. Or you have to spend 100 hours and no one else spends that much time. There's a bunch of different steps in here to material participate. And each deal, each real estate asset you own is subject to the same material participation rules. But what the tax code says is you can make an election to put all of those together. So if I am can qualify as a real estate professional to material or participate on each deal, it may be impossible for me to spend 500 hours on 20 different projects. I can make an election and group all of that together to get one 500-hour requirement or 100 hours. So the material participation is something where you have to actively be involved in that. And those rules are very clear, and your CPAs really need to understand that, and you need to understand those. That doesn't mean that if you're a passive investor that all this is for naught, you can't take those losses, because that's a lot of what we do. We do a lot of strategies to structure where we can make those losses available. So I'll use myself as an example. Sure, go ahead. Oh, yeah. You're talking my language. No, I mean, we can do a lot with that. If you're a 1099, are you married? Okay, then I'll jump into my situation. So I've got money in a couple of passive deals. I've got a CPA firm and I've got a wife. Go me. So we can structure my CPA firm to be owned partly by me, partly by my wife. My wife is lovely, but you see how many kids I got? She's got no time to be dealing with CPA work, and she's not qualified. So any money that she makes from my firm is going to be passive income to her. So if I invest in these deals with Ryan and I get a huge K-1 loss, I got passive losses. There's not much I can do it, but I've got 1099 income going to my wife. She's getting passive income. I've opened up a wealth of deductions there. And that's a lot of what we do of how to strategize that stuff. That's a big way of how we open up some of those losses. So it's really key.
Can you repeat the question for everybody?
Yeah. What would you make of the time spent as raising money, working on the financing, and working on the financials of the deal if you're a JP? Would you count that?
Yeah. Okay. Of course. She asked if you're, I guess you're speaking in a GP sense,
yeah.
If you're a lead syndicator and you're working on basically everything that goes into a deal, whether it's finding property, negotiating the loans, interviewing property management companies, talking to investors about where their K-1 is and why their CPA hasn't gotten it to them on time, all of that goes into that timing requirement. So that's really key. And one big thing you guys need to understand, I don't have a slide deck for it, but I'd love to have it. Form 8582. Know that form if you're a passive investor. Worksheet 5 tells you what your unallowed passive losses are. And trust me when I say this, more CPAs than I care to admit will leave that alone and carry forward losses. I had a client in my office last week. He's got a $200,000 capital gain on the passive investment. He had $75,000 of passive losses built up from prior years. He did the return, and he never picked up that passive loss carry forward because you know what? TurboTax isn't looking out for him. He doesn't know what he's doing. But I've seen professionals do it. A lot of CPAs overlook that because they get overworked, and you know what? Passive losses don't affect the bottom line, so they get lost. Form 8582, Worksheet 5, know that. If you're switching CPAs, if you're doing your own returns, if you got passive losses, please look at that and carry that stuff forward.
Hey Vince, just one clarification. On passive losses for passive investors, typically the main source of that is that bonus depreciation, right? Or are there other sources of passive losses
on a real estate deal?
Yeah.
Bottom line, depreciation is no different than your repairs and maintenance, than your paying salaries to your property management. At the bottom line, it's just a number. The only real difference is that depreciation is subject to recapture, which we'll talk a little bit about. But no, I mean, at the bottom line, if you, going back to my example of the $1 million property that had $2 million loss and $100,000 of income, you had a $1.9 million loss. It goes down to the individuals, whether that's passive or non-passive. And if it's passive, you just got to suspend those or find passive income to offset that against. But depreciation doesn't make a difference with regard to the amount of those losses. Loss is loss. We talked a little bit about passive income, about getting money back from your real estate investments. Distributions, when you get a distribution from your investors on a property gone well, that's not taxed to you. You don't pay tax on that directly. What that distribution really is a return of capital. And that's different than return on capital. So return of capital is, if I give you $50,000 to invest with, and then over the next 5 years, you slowly give me $2,500 a quarter back, I'm not technically paying tax on that. The only way I would pay tax on that is if the property had income. But as we're talking about, with depreciation and a lot of other things, there's probably not going to be a lot of income coming through from that. So distributions aren't typically taxed directly. What is taxed is the bottom line income and the capital gains. So what you need to know, and what Robbie kind of alluded to, is depreciation. So when you buy an asset for $1 million, I think I have my number. Did I say a million, 10 million? I've got my numbers. Let's go with 10 million. If I got an asset at $10 million, I depreciate 2 million. My tax basis is now 8 million. So if I go out there in the market and I sell it for 12 billion, my capital gain is $4 million, which is the difference between my tax basis of 8 and my sales of 12. It's not the difference between what I bought it out at 10 million. We've already depreciated $2 million out of that asset, so it lowers that basis. And what that's called is depreciation recapture, and it's exposed to a little bit higher of tax rates, but nonetheless, you repay that when you pay that, when you sell that asset. So that takes some strategy too, because a lot of people will get into telling me, hey, I'm not really interested in cost segregation depreciation. I'm just going to have to pay that back when I sell the asset. There's going to be a capital gain. I'm going to have to recapture that. Well, if I can show an investor where I can make that $2 million deductible at 37% and offset income at 37%, and you recapture and pay tax at 20% on that when you sell it, you've still made 17% on that spread of that $2 million deduction. And you're going to have that cash flow in your pocket a lot sooner when you take that depreciation than when you would if you just waited to sell that. And I'm a big proponent of the time value of money, as well as you guys, too. A dollar in my pocket today is a lot more valuable than my dollar in my pocket 5 years from now when I sell that asset. So what happens when you sell that asset? Short-term capital gain is subject to ordinary income. Ordinary income can go anywhere from 0 to 37%. So if you hold that asset for a year or less, it's going to be subject to those ordinary income tax rates. A year or longer, we get into that 20% capital gains. If you make enough money, or if you structure your income or make low money in that year, you can have long-term capital gains rates as low as 0% if you make less than $80,000 if you're married, 15% if you're making $437,000 or less. Anything over that's going to be subject to 20%. So nonetheless, capital gains are a lot better than ordinary income. So let's talk a little bit about your strategies for exiting this thing. How am I doing on time? Am I good? We got 3 days left. I really want to get into the material participation rules for you guys. 1031 exchanges. So that's a big one. As I said earlier, that's when you can defer your capital gains on your on the sale of an asset. So if you're in a real estate syndication deal, or if you have a real estate deal and you sell that and you've got a capital gain, you can do what's called a 1031 exchange. And really simplistically, what you do is you trade that property in for a new property, and whatever taxes that you would have paid on those capital gains are now deferred. You've kicked that can down the road. But what it allows for you to do is to pay zero tax on that exit. Now, 1031 exchanges are a lot harder for big syndications groups to do, because everybody in here, if we all pulled our lunch money together and went out and bought a property with these guys, I'm going to tell you at the end of it, I'm going to want to do something different than you. A 1031 deal on an apartment is hard because the LLC or whatever asset that bought that property is the one that then needs to do the 1031 exchange. So if you do a 1031 deal on a big deal, you either have to buy somebody out if they want to get out of that or just not do it. So you don't see a lot of 1031 deals in syndication groups. Some tricks around that are to buy that property with a TIC, a tenant in common. And that's a popular tactic to do if you can get a smaller group. It's harder with your bigger 100, 200 people door investment groups. But what a TIC is basically each person owns a fractional piece in that real estate. So if the three of us went into on a deal and we bought as a tenant in common and we sold it and had a big capital gain, these two guys could do a 1031 exchange on their money. I could cash out and pay taxes on mine. It's all independent of one another. So a TIC is a way to kind of get around that. It's a little bit harder because the banks, if you have a big group, they don't want to vet a lot of different people for that loan. So that makes it a little bit more difficult, but that's an option to get around there. You can stagger your investments. If you have a capital gain, somebody I was talking with about this earlier was kind of explaining this. If I've got a capital gain on a deal and I am a passive investor, when I have a capital gain, sure, I can trigger some of those passive losses, but what if it doesn't offset all that other income? Well, if I put my money into another deal and it kicks off a big depreciation deduction in that same year, I've got a passive loss. I can offset those passive losses against my passive income created from that capital gain. So a lot of what some of these more astute syndicators do is they'll structure their deals, they'll stagger their investments so that they're selling one, realizing capital gains, investing into another one, and taking those losses so they pay minimal to no taxes on that. You can also harvest some of your capital losses from the stock market. If you sell real estate, it's a capital gain. So if you've got capital losses somewhere in your portfolio or your brokerage statement, you could sell those off and harvest those and take some losses against that. You can also sell in a year where you've got lower income. As I said earlier, if you've got long-term capital gains rates and you're single and making $40,000 or less, or you're married making $80,000 or less, you'll pay 0% on that capital gain. If you're married, it's 441, 496 if you're married to get a 15% rate, 441 if you're single. So those are a lot less than the 20% rates. And again, there's a lot of different ways to get to these numbers. If we can do some tax strategies to pull out some losses from some other places, maybe we can get you into that spot where your capital gains are lower and you get those favorable rates. Conservation easements are another one. I talked about that. I'll explain it in short detail, but basically, if you own raw land and you conserve that from being commercially developed in the future, you can then take the fair market value of what that project would have been if you commercially developed it, or if you harvested the minerals off of that, and you can take a charitable deduction for the difference between what the fair market value would have been and what you bought it at. So if I had a piece of raw land that I could take timber off of and make $1 million on that timber if I sold it, but let's say I bought that land for $100,000, the IRS says you can take a $900,000 tax deduction if you put an easement on that property and conserve it and don't take any property off of it. So it's a little bit of an advanced strategy, but it works. Yes, sir. What's up? I would love to answer that right off the top of my head. I don't know, but there's requirements on that where you've got to hold that. He asked if you put an easement on a property, can you pull that easement off in the future? The IRS is very specific about that. I don't know what your timeline is, but it's something like 30 plus years. They don't want you doing it just to take the big tax deduction. They've got pieces in place to prevent that because you got to think of the philosophy behind what they're doing. You're saying I'm not going to develop this land. I'm going to keep it pure and pristine. The IRS wants you to keep it clean and preserved for the life of whatever you say you're going to do it. But I don't know the exact rules of it. Sir. Can you conserve a conservation easement? Yeah, absolutely. And I will tell you that it's one of the most heavily scrutinized IRS tactics. They call it one of their top five dirty dozen. So I'm not here to advertise bad tax advice, but what's happened is a lot of syndicators have gotten together and gotten shoddy valuations. So they'll buy, they'll put together a group and raise $5 million in Podunk, Iowa, and say, hey, we're gonna put the biggest development you've ever seen here, and it's gonna be worth $50 million. We want a $45 million charitable contribution. Well, those valuations are really getting scrutinized, and the IRS knows about that. But can you syndicate it? Yes, you can syndicate it. But what I would tell, what I've told my clients is, if you go in on a deal with that, know who you're working with and know how they're valuing that. I like the mineral conservation easement a little bit better because it's tangible to say, hey, if I took ore or iron or gas or natural gas or timber off this property, what's the value of that? What's the value of that going to be in the future? Commercial development's a little harder, but yeah, you can syndicate. You have an appraiser come out there, whatever you're doing. So if it's mineral rights, they'll say, okay, you've got so many acres of timber, it would be worth this and X in the next 5 years, and they'll provide you an appraisal on that amount. Same thing would go with commercial development too. If you said, hey, I'm going to put, you know, the next River Oaks Houston in Podunk, Iowa, and build it out to be a mega $1 million development. It has to make sense. It has to pass smell test, but an appraiser does. Structure your investments through another individual. I'm not going to push this one really big, but if you've got to really pass muster with your GPs, you got to make sure you're not violating investment SEC rules. But if you invest through, say, your children or, say, a parent who has a lower income tax bracket, and then they have capital gains that kicked off to them, then maybe your sales could be a little bit taxed at a lower rate. You got to be really careful and work with people you trust that you're not making things go wrong in that deal, but that's a way to do that. I said consider STRs. No one's really syndicating short-term rentals, but short-term rentals are subject to ordinary loss rules. So we have a lake house in Cedar Creek, and we Airbnb that. We use it part of the time, but we Airbnb it. Those losses that I pull off, and I can do a cost segregation study on that thing just like I can an apartment complex. It's just the numbers are smaller, but I can pull losses out of there. But what the tax code says on a short-term rental is that's operated more like a hotel or in that manner. If you provide substantial services, if you're cleaning that property, if you're doing the booking for it, then those losses from a short-term rental aren't subject to some of those passive rules. So that's a good way to get some losses going there too. And I'll give the operators in the room just a little bit of advice just from things we've seen over the years. Be careful about your financials when you're giving that to your group. CapEx versus repairs. CapEx obviously is capital improvements. So what the IRS does when you file your tax return, whether it's personal return or business return, they'll take your numbers on your return and do a ratio and compare it back to the industry. So if you've got a rental property that makes $300,000 a year, and you've got repair and maintenance line item expense on the return for $1 million, that's a big red flag. That's three times the value of the rent. And that's the thing that really gets missed sometimes by clients, because property managers aren't CPAs. They don't know what goes in what. So sometimes they'll dump a ton of stuff into repairs and maintenance, and that will drive up that expense. So it's really important that your CPA understands to pull that out of there, to capitalize what needs to capitalize and appreciate that. There's a safe harbor rule that says that if you have $10 million in revenues or less for the last 3 years, you're technically a small business taxpayer. Anything that you spend at $2,500 or less is a direct deduction as repairs and maintenance. So that's important to know. GPs need to know their passive loss limitations and know all of that. They need to know if they can qualify as a real estate professional each and every year. And that goes back each year. If you're a real estate professional in 2020, doesn't mean you're going to be a real estate professional in 2021 or 2022. Each and every year, you have to go back and do that 750-hour test, personal service, 50% stuff, that. I talked about your 85-82s. Everybody that invests in real estate, 85-82, worksheet 5, make sure you have your unallowed losses passive carry forwards for that. Know your, be proactive with your tax bill. I always tell our clients, there's a lot I can do for you on September, is this 23rd, 24th? Whatever the day is, there's a lot I can do for you for your 2021 tax return that I can't do on April 15th of next year for this year's tax bill. There's a wealth of things we can jump into if we plan that I can't do after the fact. If we're talking about last year's taxes, I can't change the facts for you. So be proactive with your tax bill. We talked a little bit about providing an IRA class. If you want to open up to some IRA investors, maybe consider what I've seen some syndicators do is open up a hard money option for them where they're not taking equity out of the deal, but they're offering loans so it can kind of get them out of UBIT strategies. It's just a thought process. It can open up some more money for them. Get K-1 information right. Everybody in here, when you syndicate a deal, you send a bunch of documents over to your syndication group about what your name is, your social security number, your addresses. It's really important that that stuff is correct when you send it over. It's important when you get your K-1 to look that over, because as tax returns are coming due October 15th now, I can't tell you how many syndicators I've got coming up saying, oh, Joe, who invested in my deal, meant to do this with his solo 401k, and we gave you his personal information, so what do we need to do now? Make sure you get out in front of that and look at it first, because some people can offset that and not sure what they're doing. Be transparent with your LPs. Get out in front of bad news. Any deal I've ever been on, things come up, and I'm really appreciative of the syndicators who communicate with me on a regular basis, whether it's email or text or phone call, but mainly email. Tell me what's going on with that property, and if something's not going right, I want to know about it. I don't want to get hit with a big surprise of why we're losing money all of a sudden when I had no idea that there's an eviction moratorium out there for the pandemic or this, that, or the other, and that's why our revenues have fallen out of the sky. Be proactive with them and communicate with that CPA about the timing of the K-1s. Everybody in here who invests in the deal is going to get a K-1, and that's going to go somewhere, whether your personal return, your trust, your business, wherever you invest your proceeds from. Make sure you communicate with your CPA to get that stuff out on time, because CPAs get really busy in February, March, and April. So if your investors expect to have their returns by their K-1s by April 15th, and you're just getting that information to them on April 10th, it makes you look bad. And as a CPA firm, our client really is the GP syndicator. So we truly, really try as a group to say, hey, here's our time constraints. Here's what our deadlines are. I want you to know that so you can tell your investors that, because I want these guys to look like gods to you, and if they say they're getting you a K-1 on April 15th or by April 15th, we want to make sure that's communicated. So just be open with that. And then read the financials. I think this is the last one before I jump into case studies and put you guys further to sleep, but yeah, I'm almost done. I had a client who had just bought a property in Amarillo for about $3 million, and he was looking at his financials about 2 months into the deal and noticed that his utility costs were high for what was supposed to be a 60% occupancy deal. Well, he started digging around, and what came to find out is on the rent rolls, which a rent roll is where the property manager gives the owners a list of all the units in the apartment and what's vacant and what's not vacant. What he was doing was telling the owner that the units were vacant, where in fact, what the property manager was doing was asking the tenants to pay in cash, pay the property manager in cash. He would pocket that cash, but they would live there, and the tenant didn't know any different. They were just like, this guy's weird. He wants me to pay $1,500 a month in rent in cash. And he gave me $100 savings on it if I did it. So that's cool. I saved $100 on rent. Well, my client was able to look at the utility bills, who they were providing all their utility bills, and said, these seem a little high. Let's dig in further and see what's going on. And they were able to track back to the actual units that were occupied, and they uncovered what the property manager was doing. So that's what budgeted financials can do for you. They can really open up some crazy things going on. And trust me.
Walk your vacant units.
Yeah, walk them. Know what you're doing. So I'll walk you guys through a couple of quick case studies and then open it up for questions. So this is a client who walked in our door. He's a single professional making $150,000. And I put ExxonMobil in there for Houston. So I don't know what your biggest employer down here is. As a quick aside, I had a job offer from Enron when I left school, but I didn't get to take it because, well, it was Enron. But I'll save that story for another day. Anyway, I put Exxon as your highest earner here. He makes $150,000 from Exxon. He invested $75,000 into an apartment deal 3 years ago. He's a full-time employee at Exxon, so that should tell all of you guys right now he's not a real estate professional. If he was, he would have to spend 750 hours a year in real estate. Can't do that. If he could do it, then he's got to spend 50% or more of his personal service time. Can't do that. So he's got $60,000 of passive losses built up. He comes in, his property just sold, and he's got a, he just sold this thing for $125,000. He comes to me and he says, Vince, what's my capital gain on this? I put it through TurboTax, and it looks like we're going to pay about $43,000. Well, because he's not a CPA, what he had failed to do is he had failed to pick these $60,000 up in passive losses because he forgot to pull them over. And as we said, if you have suspended passive losses, when you exit a deal, those losses are now exercisable. You can offset it that against ordinary income. He missed that point completely. And trust me, CPAs do that too. Worksheet 5 on Form 8582. Look at it. Furthermore, he was trying to say, okay, should I invest this money into another deal or should I just wait and do something else with the cash? Well, we run some numbers with him and say, if you invest $75,000 into a new deal, we project, because of cost segregation depreciation, you're going to get a loss of about $60,000 this year. So what we were able to do is we took him from filing a tax return and paying about $43,000 on $260,000 of income, all the way down to a $17.7 tax bill by utilizing his passive losses, which isn't a real big strategy, just it's important to know, and suggesting to him, if you invest into a new deal and it kicks off depreciation, those are passive losses. You've got this built-up passive income of $110,000. You can offset that against that. So we were able to save that client quite a bit of tax by doing that. And I'll go one more, give you one more case study and explain this one. This is a married couple, two kids, 11 and 17 years old. Wife makes $100,000 on a W-2 job, tech job, nothing in real estate. He makes $102,000 on a self-employed IT consulting company. And then furthermore, he kicks off about $200,000 of income from his business. They, over the quarantine, binge-watched HGTV, huge Chip and JoJo fans, and they made $100,000 on a flip. So they've got about $500,000 of income. Furthermore, they put more money into an apartment deal that kicked off about $75,000 in the first year for tax cost segregation. But as everything's structured here, it's all passive. So If this guy did absolutely nothing, he would pay $138,000 between payroll taxes, self-employment taxes, and income taxes on about $500,000 of income. What we did for him, and I'll save you the details on that because mainly can't see them, and this really isn't the tax deduction course, but we were able to knock down his W-2s. Forgive me, I forgot what we did. We hired his children, and we were able to push money out of the company into his business. We were able to reduce his wages. We were able to structure the life into the business, set that up as an S corporation, keep some passive income to her that would open up some of those passive losses, set up a medical expense reimbursement plan, blah, 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 blah. I could talk you guys into tears with this stuff, but basically we took him from $138,000 down to $50,000 of income, all on the exact same income, because we were proactive, because we sat down and explained to him what the tax code says about what how the business relates to him. We're able to make the facts work for him, completely legal, substantiated through the tax code, and that then opens up $88K of money he can put in his pocket to invest into another deal, to put his kids through college, whatever he wants to do, that's cash in his pocket. So with that said, a lot of what we do is educate our clients. It's what I'm really passionate about. I enjoy doing taxes, and I enjoy this part of working with clients and speaking to them and breaking down the tax code in hopefully a simplistic language. But if anybody wants to get in touch with me, just hit me up there. I'm around. You can take my business card. But if anybody has any questions on anything, I'd love to open it up. If not, I can just continue to talk about how the Houston Texans are going to do and what their quarterback situation is. I'm a Cowboy fan. I don't know. You're a business owner and you've got income. Can I take the losses from a real estate investment and offset against your business income? If done right, if it's just you by yourself, no. Not unless you're a real estate professional, and if you're full-time into another profession, it's going to be hard. But like I said, I'm married. I'm invested into a deal. I've got a CPA firm. My wife's a part of that CPA firm, so she gets a K-1 for a portion of the income. That income is totally passive to her. All the losses I have coming through my real estate investments are passive, so I've now matched up those passive losses against our passive income. So yes, you can do it. It takes planning, and it takes it's not something I could do for a tax return last year, but it's something I could do for this year's tax return if the facts work. You know, it's just about trying to take your puzzle and piece it together to make it operate. So it's possible. I get a K-1 from my business as a CPA owner. They cannot, my real estate losses can't offset that K-1 because I'm non-passive in my CPA business. I'm down here talking shop with you guys. This is what I do for a living. This is very non-passive income to me, but my wife is not. That's the difference. So any losses, if I was single and by myself doing the exact same thing, I get losses from a K-1 from a real estate investment, there's not much I can do. But because I've got a business and because I got a wife and because we can structure it correctly, I can get access to some of those passive losses. I could also quit my CPA gig and go be a real estate professional full time. But as much as I like that, I'm doing better at the CPA thing. I know it better. So it provides a good lifestyle for us. So it's, I can't really change that back. But my wife's different. You know, she is different. So we've got clients that have done a lot of things to quit there because their dream is to leave their full-time job and go into real estate professional status, if that's ever something you're wanting to do, we can sit down and make it out more simplistically and show you exactly what the rules say and set out a plan for you to do that. But, you know, it just takes coordination and you got to make sure that you tie those things out.
So just a quick question, Vince, is the recapture rate different than short-term or long-term capital gains rates?
It is. It's 25% for, depending on your income. So it could be capped at 25% on your
income. Max is 25.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, and it all depends what your income level is. Like I said, if you're below that 496 level for married filing joints, you can be at a lower rate. But that depreciation is recaptured. But I'll tell you guys till I'm blue in the face. If I can get that depreciation to deduct your income at a rate higher than 25% or whatever that future rate is, it's money in your pocket, right? If I can deduct that at 30%, you come back and pay it, repay it at 25%, that's still a half percent on that depreciation recapture. That's money in your pocket sooner. And that's what it is. All right, guys, I thank you for your time. Thank Ryan and Robbie. Thank you guys for everything. Is there anything else? I didn't mean to cut you off.
Any other questions, guys? Anybody? Well, thank you so much, everybody, for coming. We try to, you know, honor everyone's time commitment and start a little bit earlier on time today. So really appreciate everybody coming out. Vince, thanks again for coming all the way from Dallas and preparing the presentation. We'll send a note out, so we'll send the slides. Again, the lighting was hard to see everything, but if there's any questions, we'll also include Vince's contact information. So thank you so much, Robbie. You want to talk about the next speaker?
Thanks for coming. Yeah. So please make sure you sign in so that we have your email information. We'll make sure the decks go out to all of you guys. We are going to have our next session. I forget the exact date. We'll send it out October. We will have a multifamily broker presenting, Cheyenne Husnain. He specializes particularly in the Houston market. We'll give a lot of color and trends, what's going on in the multifamily market, how deals are going. So look forward to that, and hopefully look forward to seeing a lot of you guys back here for that.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.